Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine getting a diagnosis that, well, for far too many people, still feels like a death sentence. That's often the brutal reality with pancreatic cancer or PDA. Mm-hmm. It's just one of the most aggressive, most unforgiving cancers out there. And it's frequently caught really late, only when it's already advanced.
Yeah, what clinicians call unresectable. Basically, surgery isn't really an option at that point.
Exactly. And despite all the amazing strides we've made in medicine generally, the median survival for these advanced patients, it just stubbornly hovers at less than a year. It's truly heartbreaking.
It's a challenge that has frustrated researchers, clinicians, everyone for decades, really.
So here's the question, right? What if we could actually peel back the layers of these incredibly complex tumors, look deep inside down to their genetic code, to understand why? Why do some respond even just a little to treatment while others just don't respond at all? What if finding those specific molecular fingerprints, those little biological signatures, wasn't just like an academic thing, but could actually guide us
towards better therapies?
Yes. More personalized therapies, giving patients a real fighting chance.
And that really hits the nail on the head.
Yes.
That's been the core problem plaguing pancreatic cancer treatment for so long.
Yeah.
You see, PDDs isn't just one single disease.
It's not uniform.
Not at all. Even tumors that look similar under a microscope can behave completely differently from one patient to the next. Or even, within the same patient over time.
Wow.
This huge biological variability, we call it tumor heterogeneity, that's been a massive hurdle. It made developing a one-size-fits-all treatment basically impossible.
So you need to look deeper.
Exactly. Genomic insights are absolutely crucial here. They let us unmask those hidden differences, see the unique genetic blueprint of each tumor, at a really fundamental level.
Moving towards tailored approaches.
That's the goal. Finally getting us towards truly tailored treatments.
And that is precisely what a groundbreaking new study set out to do. It offers not just like new hope, but maybe even a roadmap for tailoring treatments, tumor by tumor, patient by patient.
Yeah, this is where precision medicine could really start to deliver on its promise for PDAC.
So today, we really want to celebrate the significant work done by the research team at the Wallace McCain Center for Pancreatic Cancer. That's at Princess Margaret Cancer Center, University Health Network, and of course, all their collaborators.
Mm-hmm. A big effort.
They've truly advanced our understanding of advanced pancreatic cancer and, importantly, laid crucial groundwork for guiding future treatment strategies.
Absolutely critical work.
Okay, so let's unpack the pressing clinical problem a bit more. Pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, PBAC, it's unfortunately getting more common globally.
Yeah, the incidence is rising.
But the real kicker, as we sort of touched on, is its insidious nature. It tends to grow silently. Symptoms often don't show up until the disease has already spread or it's just too advanced for surgery.
Which is often metastatic disease by then.
Right. This late diagnosis, unresectable or metastatic, that's the main reason the prognosis is so poor. So many patients surviving less than a year. It feels like a race against time we've consistently been losing.
And, putting that into context, the current standard treatments for advanced PDAC, they usually involve pretty powerful chemotherapy regimens.
Like FOLFIRINOX.
Exactly. Modified FOLFIRINOX or M-FOLFIRINOX is one. The other main one is gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel. We often just call it GNP.
Okay.
Now, these can offer some benefit for some patients. But what's really striking and frankly frustrating is that even with these drugs, we've seen very, very minimal improvement in overall survival over the last decade or so.
Stuck on a plateau.
Pretty much, yeah. A frustrating plateau. Now, what's critical to understand is the genomics underneath all this.
Mm-hmm.
We know over 90% of these tumors have mutations in the KRAS gene.
The big one.
The big one. It's a notorious oncogene. Think of it like a jammed on switch for cell growth.
Constantly telling cells to divide.
Right. And beyond KRAS, we also very frequently see alterations, usually loss of function, in key tumor suppressor genes. Genes like CDKN2A, TP53, and SMA4.
The brakes.
Exactly. These are normally the brakes on cell division, stopping uncontrolled growth. So when they're broken,
yeah.
Well, you can imagine.
Right.
The challenge, but also the opportunity, really lies in identifying the specific molecular features, the biomarkers, within this really complex genomic mess. That's the key, we think, to finally breaking through that plateau and improving outcomes.
Which brings us neatly to the COMPASS trial. Its clinical identifier is NCT0275-0657 for those looking it up.
Right.
This was a really important study. It was prospective, observational, and specifically designed to try and establish a comprehensive set of biomarkers in advanced PDAs.
And the timing was key.
Yes. What made it particularly insightful was that patients were enrolled before they started any chemotherapy.
Which gives you that baseline unperturbed snapshot.
Exactly. Now, the actual treatment choice, M-L-furinox or GNP, that was left up to their physician. So it wasn't a randomized trial in the classic sense.
No, it reflects more real-world practice.
But that gives us this fantastic real-world snapshot of how these molecular profiles actually correlate with outcomes under standard clinical care.
And what was truly innovative here was the sheer depth of the approach they took. They didn't just scratch the surface.
No. Yeah.
No, they performed integrated whole genome sequencing, WGS, and transcriptome sequencing, that's RNA-seq, on the patient tumor biopsies.
Okay, break that down, WGS.
Right, think of whole genome sequencing, WGS, mm-hmm. as reading every single letter in the tumor's entire DNA instruction manual, A to Z, cover to cover.
Wow, okay.
This let them map out basically everything, all the genomic mutations, those single letter changes, but also bigger things, larger structural variants, copy number changes where whole sections of DNA are copied or lost.
And structural variants, those are like major rearrangements.
Exactly. They're not just typos. They're like whole chapters being moved around, deleted, or duplicated.
Yeah.
Pieces of chromosomes breaking, flipping, joining incorrectly. These can have huge impacts on gene function and really fuel the cancer's growth.
Got it. And RNA-seq.
So RNA-seq, transcriptome sequencing, that gives you a snapshot of which genes are actively being used or expressed at that moment, which instructions are actually being read and acted upon.
So it tells you what the tumor is doing.
Precisely. It reveals gene expression patterns and lets you classify tumors into different molecular subtypes based on their activity profile.
And they were careful about the samples.
Oh, incredibly careful to make sure the data was robust, reliable. I mean, they went to great lengths. They collected a median of 6 biopsy cores per patient. It's quite a bit of tissue.
More material, better chance of seeing things.
Right. And crucially, they use something called laser capture microdissection. Fancy term. But it basically lets you precisely cut out and isolate just the tumor cells.
So you're not sequencing loads of normal tissue by accident.
Exactly. Enriching for the tumor material. And the sequencing itself was done at really high depths, average 49x coverage for the tumor, 38x for the normal samples.
Why is that depth important?
It's critical for catching everything. Hmm. Rare mutations, subtle changes, structural variants.
Yeah.
You need that depth for confidence and comprehensiveness. It's not just about more data, it's about reliable data.
So, okay, this incredibly detailed profiling, it wasn't just about making a catalog of mutations and active genes, was it?
No, not at all. The whole point was to link these really intricate molecular features, these biological fingerprints you mentioned, directly with real-world patient outcomes.
And even risk factors.
And even epidemiological risk factors, yeah. Mm. This is where that biological complexity starts to become something tangible, something clinically actionable, connecting the deep science to actual patient impact.
Let's talk about the scale then. How many patients were involved in COMPASS?
It was impressive. They profiled 268 patients with advanced PDAC, so not a small group.
Definitely not. And the follow-up?
Median follow-up was 52 months. Which is pretty significant when you're tracking outcomes for a disease with typically such a short survival time.
Gives you a longer view. And the patient demographics.
Median age was 64. And reflecting that late diagnosis issue, a large majority, 86%, had metastatic disease already. The cancer had spread beyond the pancreas.
Okay, so let's dive into the genomic findings from this deep look. KRAS mutations.
As expected, yeah, they were present in a whopping 93% of patients. Very common.
Any specific type?
The most common specific mutation was KRAS G12D. That accounted for 43% of all cases.
And what about the small group without KRAS mutations? That's 7%.
Right, the KRAS wild type, or KRAS. But for those patients, the researchers often found other significant alterations that seemed to be driving the cancer. Things like mutations in BRAF or alterations in the ERBB gene family, like ERBB2, 3, or 4.
Which is important because?
Because it suggests alternative therapeutic targets for that subset of patients. It gives them potential options beyond the standard KRAS-focused view. Maybe HR2 inhibitors or BRAF inhibitors could be relevant for them.
Makes sense. What about those tumor suppressor genes you mentioned, the breaks?
Yeah, they saw a very high frequency of loss of function mutations there too. TP53 was hit in 82% of patients, CDKN2A in 84%, and SMA4 in 47%. So the breaks are definitely off in most PD tumors.
Okay. And they looked at mutational signatures, those patterns of DNA damage.
They did. They found the expected age-related signatures, SBS1 and SBS5, sort of the normal wear and tear on DNA. They also saw SBS8, which has an unknown cause still.
But was there anything particularly actionable?
Yes. This is really key. SBS3, which is a strong indicator of deficiency in homologous recombination repair, HRD, that signature was seen in 15% of the tumors.
And HRD is important because?
Because it makes tumors potentially vulnerable to specific targeted therapies like PRP inhibitors, which are already approved for some HRD-driven cancers, like ovarian and breast. So finding this in PDA is a big deal.
Okay. And structural variants, those big rearrangements?
Loads of them. A median of 109 per tumor. And about 15% of the tumors were classified as having unstable genomes, meaning they had over 200 structural variants, just massively rearranged DNA.
Wow. Any link there?
Yes. Interestingly, these highly unstable genomes often overlapped with that HRD-PDC group we just talked about, suggesting a strong connection between that specific DNA repair defect and widespread genomic chaos.
Okay, this is fascinating, but now, the crucial part, how did all this complex molecular detail actually connect to how patients did, the clinical correlations?
Right. This is where the rubber meets the road. And the study found several really distinct molecular subgroups that profoundly impacted survival. It basically screams not all pancreatic cancers are created equal.
Let's start with one you mentioned, the basal-like subtype.
Okay, yeah. This RNA subtype, they found it in about 19% of patients. And it consistently showed a very poor prognosis. These patients just did much worse overall.
What was unique about them molecularly?
Well, what's really striking is that these basal-like tumors were often enriched in tumors that had, the researchers called, major imbalances in mutant KRAS.
Meaning
they had an increased dosage, like extra copies, of the mutated KRAS gene. So it suggests that maybe it's not just having the KRAS mutation, but the amount of that mutant driver that really ramps up the aggressiveness.
That makes sense. Anything else about them?
Yeah, their tumor microenvironment, the TME, was also very distinct. It looked inflamed in some ways with certain immune cells around. But crucially, it also expressed higher levels of co-inhibitory molecules, things like PD-L1.
The immune breaks.
Exactly. Think of them as signals telling the immune system to back off, putting the immune cells to sleep right there in the tumor. It creates an immunosuppressive state where the body's defenses just can't fight the cancer effectively.
Making them harder to treat.
Extremely hard. And their median overall survival reflected that. It was significantly lower, dropping to just 6.5 months, especially if they got the Ofulfirinox chemotherapy.
Oof. Okay, but was there any group that showed more promise?
Yes, thankfully. That homologous recombination deficient group, the HRD-PDA subgroup, identified in about 13% of patients using a high score called HR Detect.
What about them?
They actually had improved overall survival. And really importantly, having that HRD profile was predictive of a better response to the Ofulfirinox chemotherapy.
Ah, so that's a direct treatment implication.
Absolutely. It's powerful support for biomarker-driven treatment. Identifying HRD early could point clinicians towards Ofulfirinox or maybe even adding a PARP inhibitor down the line, tailoring therapy right from the start.
Okay, what else stood out as affecting prognosis?
Another really crucial negative indicator was systemic inflammation. They measure this using something called the Gustave Rossi Immune Score, or GRIM-S.
Systemic meaning body-wide.
Exactly. Patients with a high GRIM-S signaling this sort of body-wide inflammatory response also had a consistently poor prognosis.
And what did their tumors look like?
Well, especially tumors that had spread to the liver, they tended to have fewer CD8 plus T cells. Those are your critical killer T cells that hunt down and destroy cancer cells.
So fewer killers getting in.
Right. It suggests what we call a cold or immune-excluded TME. The immune soldiers aren't effectively infiltrating the tumor battlefield. Interestingly, this high inflammation group was also associated with having larger tumors at the start.
Suggesting a link between inflammation and just more aggressive, bulky disease.
Seems likely, yeah.
You also mentioned something fascinating about KRAS itself, the allelic states.
Yes, this is a really nuanced finding. So we talked about the major imbalances in mutant KRAS, as they call this KRASmage, found in about 17% of patients.
And it did worse.
Significantly worse. Median OS was just 6.3 months, much lower response rates to chemo. But here's the really intriguing part.
Go on.
Almost 40%, 38% specifically of these KRASmage patients also had pre-existing type 2 diabetes.
Wow, really? What's the potential link?
Well, it highlights this potential, maybe underappreciated connection between metabolic pathways, how the body handles sugar, and this aggressive KRAS dosage state. It suggests glucose metabolism might be fueling, or at least strongly contributing to, the aggressiveness of these specific tumors. It's a whole new avenue for research.
Well, absolutely. And the flip side, what about balanced KRAS?
Right. Tumors with a balanced KRAS allelic dosage, which they called CrasBall, that was about 41% of patients, they actually had the longest median OS, 11.2 months, and the highest response rates to chemo.
So it's not just if you have KRAS mutation, but how much mutant KRAS you have relative to the normal copy.
Exactly. The context and the dosage of that mutation seem to profoundly matter for prognosis and treatment response. It's a much more complex picture than we thought.
Did they only look at metastatic disease or locally advanced too?
They included locally advanced pancreatic cancer, LAPC as well. It was about 14% of the group.
And how did they fare?
As you might expect, better. Median OS was 12.5 months for LAPC, compared to about 8.4 months for the metastatic cases.
But were they molecularly different too?
Very much so. What was really notable is that the LAPC cases specifically lacked those major imbalances in mutant KRAS. They were almost exclusively the classical RNA subtype, not the aggressive basal-like.
Interesting.
And they also showed lower genomic instability overall and didn't have those high systemic inflammation scores, the high GRIMS.
So what does that suggest?
It really suggests there might be fundamentally different biological drivers at play when the disease is still localized versus when it has spread. It implies we might need to think about and maybe treat early stage and late stage PDI as distinct entities, even at the molecular level.
One last finding, they looked at biopsies after treatment too.
Yes. Biopsies taken after the chemotherapy had stopped working, when the cancer was progressing again.
What did they see?
They saw a clear increase in the burden of new mutations, insertions, deletions, and structural variants compared to the biopsies taken before treatment.
So the genome became even more unstable.
Exactly. It paints this picture of rising genomic instability as the disease advances and develops resistance. It hints at how the cancer adapts and evolves to try and outmaneuver our therapies. That genomic evolution is likely a key reason why treatments often become less effective over time.
Okay, so stepping back, what's the big picture impact here?
Well, what's really impactful is how consistently these findings point to that basal-like RNA subtype and also systemic inflammation, the high GRIMS score, as being crucial high-risk indicators, poor prognosis factors.
And understanding these profiles is key.
It's absolutely vital. It's not just about categorizing tumors anymore. It's about providing a much clearer blueprint to guide future treatment decisions and hopefully design much more effective targeted therapies.
So we move from treating pancreatic cancer to treating...
to treating, for example, basal-like PDAC with CRESMAGE and high systemic inflammation. It's that level of precision we need.
So let's talk practical implications. What does this mean for the clinic?
Well, it strongly suggests that patients with, say, basal-like PDA, or those with high systemic inflammation, they probably need completely different treatment strategies than someone would, say, HRD-PDAC.
How so?
For instance, given that weird TME in basal-like tumors inflamed but immunosuppressed, maybe future treatments need to combine things, like a KRAS inhibitor plus a novel immunotherapy specifically designed to wake up those suppressed immune cells.
So it demands different blueprints.
Exactly. These distinct molecular subtypes seem to demand entirely different treatment blueprints. It's not just tweaking a dose of chemo. It's fundamentally rethinking the approach based on the tumor's biology, moving away from one-size-fits-all towards a truly precision attack.
And it sounds like it really hammers home the need for biomarker testing early on.
Absolutely. Unequivocally, that finding about HRD-PDA responding better to M-fulfirinox, that tells us we should be identifying these patients right at the start, ideally before treatment even begins.
To get them on the potentially best therapy first.
Yeah. Precisely. And that link between CRESMAGE and type 2 diabetes, that's just fascinating, isn't it?
It really is.
It points directly to the importance of metabolic pathways in driving aggressiveness. It opens up totally new avenues for research. Could we target glucose metabolism in those specific patients? It's a call to look beyond just the genome for therapeutic vulnerabilities.
Of course, every study has limitations, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's crucial to be transparent about them.
Yeah.
This was, as we said, non-randomized. The chemo choice was up to the doctor. That introduces potential bias. Maybe sicker patients got one drug versus the other, for instance.
Okay.
And the RNA-based immune profiling, while valuable, it mostly looked at the tumor-enriched stuff. So it might not fully capture the entire immune landscape around the tumor.
The broader neighborhood.
Yeah, the broader neighborhood. But That being said, the results were remarkably consistent across many different analyses. Mm-hmm. That really strengthens the findings, makes them feel robust despite those limitations.
And there's follow-up work happening.
Yes. Crucially, there's an ongoing trial called PASS-ERA-1. It's a randomized study designed to validate and expand on these COMPASS findings. That's the next critical step to hopefully bring these insights into routine clinical practice much faster.
So wrapping this up, this deep dive really shows us that advanced pancreatic cancer isn't just one monolithic disease. It's clearly a collection of distinct, molecularly defined subgroups. Mm-hmm. And by using this integrated genomic and transcriptomic profiling, we can actually identify these unique molecular and systemic fingerprints.
Fingerprints that profoundly impact patient outcomes.
Exactly. And that guides us towards more personalized and hopefully much more effective treatments down the road.
So the big question becomes, what does this mean for how we fundamentally approach PDAC diagnosis and treatment in the clinic day to day? And maybe more urgently, how quickly can these vital insights really translate from the lab into direct life-changing patient benefit?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, Base by Base.